Well, it would seem that a number of people have taken this four-day weekend to gallivant, as my grandmother used to say. They're off gallivanting. Well, a great welcome to those of you who did come this morning. Thank you for coming out. We'll go ahead as if nothing had happened. As always, we have announcements. Seva Saturday for this month is next Saturday, July 13th. Please do note that on your calendar. For those of you who aren't aware, Seva Saturday runs from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Lunch is provided. Of course, you don't have to come for the whole 4 hours. Come as you can, serve as you are able, and as practical for you. Also, please plan to attend our weekend retreat on Karma Yoga on the 20th and 21st of this month. On Saturday the 20th, the retreat program will start at 10 a.m. and end at 4:30, our regular schedule, with an hour and a half break for lunch and rest. Swami Chandrasekharanandaji, head of the Portland, Oregon Vedanta Society, will lead Saturday's gathering. There will be a reception and potluck supper for him after Arati that evening, on Saturday evening. On Sunday morning, the Swami will speak on the true joy of living. We also have Swami Bodhanandaji coming in September of this year, and Swami Yogatmanandaji will come for his annual visit at the end of November. For those of you who don't know those two swamis, Swami Bodhananda is the head of the Sambodh Foundation, which has activities both here in the United States and in India, very extensive. And he comes to Atlanta once a year and always comes to see us. He's very dear to Swarna Shaw, so Swarna manages his schedule while he's here. Swami Yogatmananda is head of the Providence, Rhode Island Center, and is one of the most senior swamis now in the United States, the most senior swamis in the Ramakrishna Order now in the United States. We're always so glad to have him come. Please note that your center will be closed in August. No activities except evening arati. This will be our routine each summer now. So have I forgotten any announcements that I should make? All right. Well, we'll open with our beautiful chant that helps us recollect our purpose here this morning and our relationship with the Divine Presence. Om Sahana Vavatu, Sahano Bhunaktu, Saha Viryam Karavavahai, Tejas Vinavaditamastu, Ma Vidvishavahai. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. May the Divine Being look over us lovingly as a mother and father. May the Divine Being support and nourish us as a mother and father. May we have the strength and skill to study together the art of spirituality. May no misunderstandings arise amongst us. Om Peace. Peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. For those of you who haven't heard, the reason I'm mentioning this, the reason it comes to mind, is that translation of that ancient prayer is by our beloved Swami Yogeshananda. Quite remarkably, Yogeshananda has somewhat recovered. He is feeling much better. His kidney function has improved. He attended the July 4th celebration in Tribuco, and he's taking his meals with the other sadhus at the Tribuco Monastery now. So he's no longer in hospice care. There is a 24-hour caregiver, and he's still in a special room outfitted as a hospital room. But things are much improved. So that's the latest news on Swami Yogeshanandaji. Now, this song that I'm about to read you the lyrics for, the reason I'm going to read you the lyrics is that I haven't rehearsed it enough in order to sing it creditably. But as you listen to the rest of the talk, you will see the relevance of this. This is called Fixing a Hole, and it's by the Beatles. I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go. I'm filling the cracks that ran through the door and kept my mind from wandering where it will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, I'm right where I belong, I'm right where I belong. See the people standing there who disagree and never win and wonder why they don't get in my door? I'm painting my room in a colorful way, and when my mind is wandering, there I will go. There I will go. And it really doesn't matter if I'm wrong, I'm right where I belong, I'm right where I belong. Silly people run around, they worry me and never ask me why they don't get past my door. I'm taking the time for a number of things that weren't important yesterday, and I still go, and I still go. I'm fixing that hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go, where it will go. I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and stops my mind from wandering where it will go, where it will go. This song is, of course, about the transformation that comes with spiritual practice. Rain, in folk and popular music, is a metaphor for suffering, for samsara. So I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in, where samsara gets in, and keeps my mind from wandering where it will go, which is to a higher place. So this is a beautiful song, and it was very, very popular when it was published in, I believe, the 1960s or early 70s. So, as you'll see the relevance as the talk develops. As introduction, July is a month for the study of Karma Yoga, a spiritual path leading to the abandonment of selfishness. Why abandonment of selfishness? When we're selfish, our mind is constantly disturbed by thoughts of how is this affecting me? How is this affecting me? What's going to happen to me? When we abandon that selfishness, we have the ability to attain a calm because we're not thinking in terms of ourselves, we're thinking in terms of others and of the unity itself. As a karma yogi, you practice offering your actions and their results, as well as your perceptions, thoughts, and feelings to the divine presence. Even before fully knowing this presence, you hold firmly to the belief that the presence is within each person or other living being that you interact with or serve. Working and abiding in this spirit, you are increasingly able to release attachment to your activities and their results. This yields the freedom and contentment promised by Karma Yoga. As Sri Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, even a little practice of this yoga will save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. So this morning's talk, the topic is, what do you rehearse? And the subject matter is about transformation. Spiritual practice allows you to observe your thoughts and feelings, your personal inner reality. As you practice concentration and meditation, the reality that you inhabit, that you abide in most of the time, is what intrudes on your concentration and your practice of meditation. So you, over time, you become quite familiar with the contents of your waking awareness, of your subconscious or dream state, because you enter that state, actually, when you are practicing meditation. It's called yoga nidra, yoga sleep. And you even, after some long time, come to understand your latent subconscious, though the root causes of what appears in your subconscious or dream state and also in your waking awareness. So spiritual practice allows you to observe your thoughts and feelings, your personal inner reality. As you learn to watch your thoughts, you realize that subconsciously you affirm again and again a particular version of reality. These affirmations are rehearsals. We are constantly rehearsing the play that you believe in and the roles you have learned to enact. You're a mother. You're a sister. You're a daughter. You're a worker at work. All of these and more are roles that you have learned to successfully enact. And yet, as we'll discover, they are in no way even close to a definition of who you truly are. Great spiritual teachers tell us that the play itself and the characters you appear to be are nothing more than fabrications of your mind. For example, sage Vasishtha told Lord Rama, quote, "The mind stuff, citta, the mind stuff is the cause of the existence of all material objects. As long as there is citta, the three worlds, waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep, also appear in one's perceptions as real." This is from the book Nectar of Supreme Knowledge. You can find a copy in the bookshop. So I'll just repeat what Vasishtha told Rama in the course of his instruction to Rama. He said, "The mind stuff, citta, is the cause of the existence of all material objects. As long as there is citta," in other words, as long as we have this material frame, as long as we have this stardust spacesuit, "as long as there is citta, the three worlds, waking, dreaming, and dreamless sleep, also appear in one's perception as real. Therefore, what you're experiencing as you sit here this morning is indeed the highest reality seen through the veils of time, space, and causation, Maya. They are what give rise to the citta, the mind stuff. Vasishtha says, your mind stuff is the instrument by which Maya manifests what you perceive as real." Swami Vivekananda often referred to this state of being, this way that we are ordinarily, as a lesser reality. Adi Shankaracharya called it a relative reality, not the ultimate reality. Yet, as Swami Vivekananda insists, this lesser reality, which is caused by your past and present thoughts and actions, can be changed by new actions and different thoughts. You can quite deliberately rewrite your play. So you immediately see the connection with karma yoga. Karma means action. If you change your actions, if you change your thoughts, particularly if you change the way you perceive and deal with the thoughts that arise in you, there will be a change in the way you are, that is, how you act. And as Swami Swahananda often said, the only true measure of spiritual progress is change in behavior. Now, I'm going to give some examples this morning of people who rewrote their plays. I'll introduce this one woman and then come back to her later. Her name is Jill Bolte Taylor. So, for example, a Harvard University neurologist, Jill Bolte Taylor, had a massive stroke that took her left hemisphere mind completely offline. As a result, not willfully, she no longer had a sense of willfulness at all, but as a result of her left mind essentially ceasing all of its functions, she discovered a right hemisphere personality of which she had been completely unaware. This was a very blissful place, this right hemisphere reality, this right hemisphere personality. It was fully there. She was simply so preoccupied with her left hemisphere activities that she had not been aware, as most of us are not aware, of our right hemisphere personality. As Taylor worked for years to regain her left brain functions, she learned, quote, "Nothing external to me has the power to take away my peace of heart and mind. That is completely up to me." I'm going to read that again. This is something she independently discovered, and it is an absolute article of faith in this tradition and is very much a part of the teachings of Patanjali. "Nothing external to me has the power to take away my peace of heart and mind." Notice she talks about the heart, as she discovered that the heart is indeed the seat of consciousness, which was, as you can imagine, to a neuroscientist, this was revolutionary thinking. "Nothing external to me has the power to take away my peace of heart and mind. That is completely up to me. I may not be in total control of what happens to my life, but I certainly am in charge of how I choose to perceive my experience." This is from her book, My Stroke of Insight. I recommend that as reading for any spiritual aspirant. It is such an inspiring book. This morning, we will explore the meaning of these ideas and how they integrate with the practice of karma yoga. Some of you have heard this song sung here by Cindy Craven. It's called Love Shining Peace. And there's a refrain in it that says, "There's a wonder in the way we're always free to change the world by changing how we see." And this aspect of vision, how we see. Consider this. Bo Lato, that's his real name, Bo Lato, is a neuroscientist and an artist who studies perception. He is founder of Lotto Lab, a hybrid art studio and science laboratory. With glowing interactive sculpture and old-fashioned peer-reviewed research, he's illuminating the mysteries of the brain's visual system. The British Science Association says of Lotto, "All his work attempts to understand the visual brain as a system defined not by its essential properties, but by its past ecological interactions with the world. In this view, the brain evolved to see what proved useful to see, to continually redefine normality." In the view of the discoveries made by Lotto, the brain evolved to see what proved useful to see, to continually redefine normality. Lotto has proven, this is what's asserted by the British Science Association. Lotto has proven no one is an outside observer of nature. Each of us is defined by our ecology. Ecology is necessarily relative, historical, and empirical. So what we're talking about now is the nature of citta, the nature of this mind stuff. No one is an outside observer of nature. Each of us is defined by our ecology. Ecology is necessarily relative, historical, and empirical. Just so we are talking from the same definition, here's the definition of ecology as a noun. It is the branch of biology dealing with the relations and interactions between organisms and their environment, including other organisms. Second definition, also called human ecology, the branch of sociology concerned with the spacing and interdependence of people and institutions. So as we go through this next part of the talk, which has to do with some examples, you'll see we're definitely dealing with the relations and interactions between organisms and their environment, and we're dealing with the sociological aspects of the spacing and interdependence of people and institutions. Here are three examples of people who successfully and dramatically redefined themselves. They rewrote the play. They rewrote the play that they were given, and the reason for making this so explicit is that we have that ability to climb higher and higher through karma yoga and the other yogas, the use of the practices of the other yogas, climb higher and higher. As Sri Ramakrishna said, you can visualize spiritual practice as climbing stair steps to the roof. We're talking about moving higher and higher from lesser reality. As Vivekananda said, we do not move from error to truth. If you will, we move from lesser truth to higher truth. So that's what we're talking about here. And so see these three people do this. The first example is Temple Grandin, PhD. Dr. Grandin didn't talk until she was 3.5 years old, communicating her frustration instead by screaming and humming. In 1950, Temple was diagnosed with autism. And when the diagnosis was given to her mother, the physician who gave the diagnosis said, you have no choice but to institutionalize her. She's hopeless. Well, blessedly, Temple Grandin's mother reacted with horror and said, no, I am not going to institutionalize her. I'm not going to give up hope on her. And listen to what happened. Grandin tells her story of groping her way from the far side of darkness in her book Emergence, labeled Autistic. A book which stunned the world because, until its publications, most professionals and parents assumed that an autism diagnosis was virtually a death sentence for achievement or productivity in life. So, Grandin's mother worked with her. She insisted that she would not be treated in any special way, she would not be institutionalized, and she made her go to school with the other children. Even though Grandin was considered weird in her young school years, she eventually found a mentor who recognized her interests and abilities. And she was severely autistic. This was not just a child mildly autistic, not at that end of the scale. She was severely autistic. She developed her talents into a successful career as a livestock handling equipment designer, one of very few in the world. She has designed the facilities in which half the cattle are handled in the United States, consulting for firms such as Burger King, McDonald's, Swift, and others. If you read her book or watch the movie about her, I'm sorry, the title of the movie has gone out of my mind, but if you just Google Temple Grandin, it'll come right up. It really tells this story in dramatic and absolutely heart-fulfilling detail. Dr. Grandin has become a prominent author and speaker on the subject of autism because, quote, I have read enough to know that there are still many parents, and yes, professionals too, who believe that once autistic, always autistic. This dictum has meant sad and sorry lives for many children diagnosed, as I was, in early life as autistic. To those people, it is incomprehensible that the characteristics of autism can be modified and controlled. However, I feel strongly that I am living proof that they can. That's a quote from her book. So the mind stuff and its relationships to other organisms, there's something in this woman, Temple Grandin. By the way, she teaches at the University of Colorado. She's a PhD. She conducts classes every day. She's still alive. She had somehow one of the aspects of our, sometimes when we have a deficit, it's accompanied by some advantage. She had an extraordinary sensitivity to cattle and other livestock, but especially cattle. She knew what they were feeling by their body language. And this is how she ended up designing what she's designed and becoming a consultant. And she continues to speak. She was in Athens not so very long ago, maybe 2 years ago. I wasn't able to go, unfortunately. So that's the first example of someone who radically reoriented herself based on, first, the wonderful belief that two people had in her. First, her mother, and second, this mentor that was mentioned. He was a remarkable teacher and helped her bring out. He didn't dismiss her because of her deficits. He celebrated her for her capabilities. Second example, James Doty, MD. Doty is an American neurosurgeon, entrepreneur, and philanthropist. Doty's interests stem from growing up in a family on public assistance, welfare. And if you read his book, The Magic Shop, it's very touching, the description. He grew up on the desert of Southern California near Palmdale. And it's very touching, this growing up on public assistance with parents who were pretty compromised. Alcohol and so on. As a result of his upbringing, he witnessed a puzzling paradox. Those with power, influence, or position often do not intervene in situations where others are suffering. And conversely, so I'll read that again, I kind of fouled it up. Those with power, influence, or position often do not intervene in situations where others are suffering. And conversely, he saw those with little or nothing, often giving everything they have to help someone who has even less. Doty's life changed at age 13 years when he walked into a magic shop one summer. He'd just gotten interested in magic. And he found out there was a magic shop there in town, so he went there. The owner of the magic shop was not there, but the owner's mother was. After talking with Doty for a while, she offered to teach him something that could, quote, could change your life if he agreed to meet with her daily for the remaining 6 weeks of summer. So once again, here is a mentor. This is always so important. Someone who believes in us. She saw something extraordinary in this 13-year-old child and said, if you'll make the effort to meet with me every day for the rest of the 6 weeks of summer, I'll teach you something that can change your life. He did meet with her, and during that time, she taught him a meditation and visualization practice. Doty says, quote, she changed my life by changing my perspective from one of limited to no possibilities, to one of endless possibilities. Prior to this, Doty says that oftentimes he felt he was like a leaf being blown by an ill wind. You can imagine a child growing up in a very disadvantaged home, the bleak desert community of the Southern California desert. He felt like he was like a leaf being blown by an ill wind. The son of an invalid mother, raised in poverty, he worked hard in school, so that when he got into Tulane University, he could work even harder. Result, he got into medical school and became a doctor. And again, if you read the book, it's really quite a remarkable story of how hard he had to work because he didn't come from any kind of privilege. There was no one... All they saw was this ill-dressed, relatively ill-mannered young man who had not learned the ways of the world and had nothing in the way of material advantages. Nevertheless, he persevered, he worked hard, he became an MD. At Stanford University in 2007, Doty began collaborative research explorations into the neuroscience of compassion and altruism with his Stanford colleagues. As part of his interest in these subjects, he met with His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who was so intrigued by the work that Doty had begun that the Dalai Lama made a personal donation of $150,000, which was soon thereafter followed by donations of $2 million by others on whom the Dalai Lama had influence. What had begun as an informal research initiative, called Project Compassion, was formalized within Stanford's School of Medicine as the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education, CCARE. CCARE is now, CCARE is now recognized throughout the world as a leading research and educational institution, and the only such institution solely focused on the study of compassion, altruism, and empathy. So here again, we see an example of someone not content to live within the limitations of what Maya had dealt to him, and so rewrote the play. I told you I would come back to Jill Bolte Taylor. This is from her book, My Stroke of Insight. Again, a book highly recommended. This now is quote. This is quote from her. "One of the greatest lessons I learned was how to feel the physical component of emotion. Joy was a feeling in my body. Peace was a feeling in my body. I thought it was interesting that I could feel when a new emotion was triggered. I could feel new emotions flood through me and then release me." I told you she was in a state where her left mind cognition, her left mind apparatus, was offline, and so she was living in this right mind, this right hemisphere. This is where she discovered the feelings that emotions produce an actual sensation in our body. "I had to learn new words to label these feeling experiences, and most remarkably, I learned I had the power to choose whether to hook into a feeling and prolong its presence in my body or just let it quickly flow right out of me." I learned that I had the power to choose whether to hook into a feeling and prolong its presence in my body or just let it quickly flow out of me. I made my decisions based upon how things felt inside. There were certain emotions like anger, frustration, or fear that felt uncomfortable when they surged through my body. So I told my brain that I didn't like that feeling and didn't want to hook into those neural loops. Jill Bolte Taylor did not know the word samskara or vasana. She, as a neuroscientist, invented this term neural loop. If you read her definition of neural loop, it is a perfect description
or what happens when a samskara is triggered. This is what she means by a neural loop. And Sri Krishna describes it in the Gita. He describes it very eloquently, what happens when we hook into certain neural loops, particularly anger, and how they just lead us down and down and down, and finally we lose all discrimination, all our ability to make any kind of reasonable decision. And like Krishna, like Patanjali, Jill Bolte Taylor said, I learned I had the power. I told my brain that I didn't like that feeling and didn't want to hook into those neural loops. I learned that I could use my left mind through language to talk directly to my brain and tell it what I wanted and what I didn't want. Upon this realization, I knew I would never return to the personality I had been before. This is rewriting the play. I suddenly had much more to say about how I felt and for how long, and I was adamantly opposed to reactivating old, painful, emotional circuits. I was adamantly opposed to reactivating old, painful, emotional circuits. Now, any of you who practice concentration and meditation know exactly what she's talking about. These things pop up, they demand our attention, and we can, like Jill Bolte Taylor, learn simply to say no, to simply turn our attention elsewhere, not to suppress them, not to say, bad and wrong, go away. No, you simply turn your attention to something more auspicious, something higher. Over time, those old neural loops, those old samskaras, become less and less powerful, and finally powerless. I suddenly had much more to say about how I felt and for how long, and I was adamantly opposed to reactivating old, painful emotional circuits. Paying attention to what emotions feel like in my body has completely shaped my recovery. For those of you who do practice concentration and meditation, you understand the word pratyahara. Pratyahara is control of the senses. This is exactly what she's talking about. I spent 8 years watching my mind analyze everything that was going on in my brain. Notice that the mind and the brain are not equivalent thoughts anymore for her. They started out that way as a neuroscientist. I spent 8 years watching my mind analyze everything that was going on in my brain. Each day brought new challenges and insights. The more I recovered my old files, the more my old emotional baggage surfaced, and the more I needed to evaluate the usefulness of preserving its underlying neural circuitry. This is a neuroscientist talking about how to rewrite your play. Emotional healing was a tediously slow process, but well worth the effort. Emotional healing, the practice of meditation, is emotional healing. Bathing in His name, that bath for weary souls. Emotional healing was a tediously slow process, but well worth the effort. As my left brain became stronger, it seemed natural for me to want to blame other people for external or to blame other people or external events for my feelings or circumstances. But realistically, by realistically, she now means from the perspective of her right hemisphere consciousness, her right hemisphere personality. But realistically, I knew that no one had the power to make me feel anything except for me and my brain. Nothing external to me had the power to take away my peace of heart and mind. That was completely up to me. I may not be in total control of what happens to my life, but I certainly am in charge of how I choose to perceive my experience. It's as if she had taken parts of chapter 1 and chapter 2 of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras and rewritten them. But she didn't know anything about Patanjali. She simply rediscovered this on her own. And how does Sri Krishna say, as the practice of Karma Yoga, what does he say to do with all of this emotional baggage, all of these things that would leave us confused and distracted? He says, offer it all to me. Offer it all to the Divine Presence. Jill Bolte Taylor, learned that she could simply turn her attention away from it. One very productive way of turning your attention away from these limitations is to offer them to the Divine Presence. This is what Sri Krishna says. And I mean, you go through chapter 3 of the Gita, there's a long, long, long list that he gives, trying to be comprehensive. Bad, good, indifferent, he says, offer it all to me. So this is our way of doing this as a practice of Karma Yoga. But we can take great instruction from these three examples of Temple Grandin, James Doty, and Jill Bolte Taylor. Vivekananda. The finer is always the cause, the grosser the effect. So the external world, the world that we're experiencing, the external world is the effect, the internal the cause. That play that we're writing or have written that we believe in, that's the cause of the gross world that we experience. Vivekananda continuing. There cannot be a cause without an effect. The present must have had its cause in the past and will have its effect in the future. If we change what's happening in the present, if we rewrite the play in the present, what Vivekananda is saying, the future must change. There's no choice. The effects are produced by the finer causes. If we change the causes, the effects must change. Sri Krishna. This is from Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13. The body is called the field of action because humans sow seeds of action in it and reap their fruits. Wise ones say the knower of the field is he who watches what takes place within his body. Doesn't that sound like what happened to Jill Bolte Taylor? And it's, if you read sections of Doty's book and Temple Grandin's experiences, they all learn to be aware of what's going on within the body. nor of the field, is he who watches what takes place within the body. Everything that is done and talked about here has as its goal realization of the One, realization of your divine inner nature. Call it how you will, from whatever perspective you come. So this karma yoga way, each of these people that was given as an example acted with great strength and determination. We do not overcome the world, as Jesus put it. We do not overcome the world idly. We overcome the world, we overcome the maya that we were dealt as the karma, the mind stuff that we were dealt as a child. We overcome it and change it by our actions. And as a result, then, the behavior changes, improves. You are less distracted. You have greater peace of mind. And you have the ability to see more clearly. And so you make better decisions. And so it's an ascending spiral. Ascending spiral. Yes, it'll sometimes go a little down, but over time, it's an ascending spiral. So this is our challenge. Are we willing to allow the status quo? Are we willing to just relax into the flow of things and, hey man, just, you know, go with the flow. No. I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and keeps my mind from wandering where it will go. I'm taking some action. And then I'll repeat those lovely lines from Cindy's song. There's a wonder in the way we're always free to change the world by changing how we see. Any of you who like the Beatles music, you can find on YouTube, you can find the recording of them singing Fixing a Hole. It's really, it's uplifting, it's joyous. I'm fixing a hole where the rain gets in and keeps my mind from wandering where it will go, where it will go. It's lovely. Now comes the part where we share with one another. And it's the best part of the time we're together. So please just speak out, ask, say, comment, question, whatever it is. Where does this all leave you? Yes, dear.
I think in that story about the doctor in your story, mm-hmm.
James Doty, yes.
When he was feeling like he was being blown about by the ill wind,
mm-hmm.
maybe somewhere in there he, to continue your bhakti karma cocktail, he probably had faith in him, because I think Sri Ramakrishna says, be like the dry leaf that is blown about in the wind,
mm-hmm.
the wind of grace is always blowing and set mm-hmm. your sails. So probably he had that. He had his...
As a child, he did not. He felt very bleak. He was an unusual child. Bullies beat him up and stole his bicycle. Because he was, from the wrong side of the tracks. So no, in the beginning, it was this woman who awakened in him first his belief in himself, as Swami Vivekananda says. It used to be said that an atheist was one who did not believe in God. I tell you that now an atheist is someone who does not believe in himself. So this wonderful woman, if you want to read the book, it's called The Magic Shop by James Todi. This wonderful woman awoke in him a belief in himself, because she helped him practice some capabilities that were there, but he didn't know how to use them at all. So this meditation and visualization series of techniques that she taught him. So, yes, Dr. Mudge.
The topic that you discussed today is very, very important. It made me think of a number of things. Because now we understand the autistic people a lot more. And actually, autistic people are artistic people, they are not autistic people. But we just fail to see the focus in their mind. They are differently focused. But they are extraordinarily bright many times. And what happens now, whenever a person who behaves little bit different from what we call normal, then normal people get together and decide he's subnormal. He's abnormal, but it could be hypernormal, not subnormal. But we decide. And therefore I would say even the approach that meditation will be one of the keys needs to be qualified. To me, meditation is not a remedy for all of them. But many times, the meditation only does the moving beam of light, the meditation needs to fix on it. And when it fixes, then it creates an opportunity to fix the problem.
Yes.
Other than that, meditation might not work too much. For example, I was thinking about Samuel Johnson, one of the extremely bright, men that we have produced and seen, not only in England, but all around. He was very peculiar. And because of that, a lot of research has been done on him, that why was he the way he was? And then later on, the brain findings after his death, they said he definitely had a mental disorder. And that's what made him so brilliant. And there was no remedy or there was no medication for that disorder at that time. And they say, we have to thank God that medicine was not employed, otherwise he would not be himself. So this goes in a number of spiral ways, and I don't know what's the truth, but we do. I think, I was also thinking of the movie One Flew Over Cuckoo's Nest. It makes you think. Because we talk the same language, that doesn't mean that we are normal people.
No, indeed not. There's a wonderful story about Dr. Johnson, this peculiar man that Dr. Mudge was just talking about. At the time he was alive, there was a great London exposition, and many buildings were built, all of glass. It's really quite remarkable. And So Dr. Johnson's friends told him, "Oh, Dr. Johnson, you must see this. It's worth seeing." And Dr. Johnson, being himself, as Dr. Mudge said, Dr. Johnson replied to their comment that it's worth seeing. Worth seeing, no doubt, but not worth going to see.
That's it.
So, this is, again, the self-determined individual, and Dr. Johnson, Samuel Johnson, definitely was very self-determined. This is the characteristic of the spiritual aspirant, that they are self-determined. They do not allow themselves to be determined by what they were given at birth, and they do not allow themselves to be determined by what this fellow Bo Lato calls your ecology. You do not allow yourself to be determined by it.
I think each case is so different that you cannot apply the same standard to each case. For example, I was thinking of Tennyson's poem, "Whom they brought her, warrior dead, and she would not utter cry, and all her watching maidens said, she must weep or she will die." So when the warrior was brought dead, the widow was so powerfully overtaken that she showed no expression. And everyone was worried about her.
Mm-hmm.
And they tried all kinds of things. Oh, he was so good. He was so handsome. He would have been a wonderful father. But the widow was completely emotionless and therefore motionless. And then a 90-year-old nurse, she got up, picked up her baby, widow's baby, and put in the lap of the widow, and she suddenly burst into tears. "Sweet my child, I live for thee." So, what I'm saying that the best thing about the spirituality is to create an open mind. That's why we admire monks, because they don't easily conclude on someone and give up on them.
An open mind. What do we mean by an open mind? That's a wonderful expression. What do we mean by an open mind? A mind that will not be imprisoned.
Yes.
A mind that will not be, that resists limitation. No, you're right. You're absolutely right, Dr. Mudge, that we must have an open mind. The minute we have a closed mind, William Blake said, when we have a closed mind, the reptiles breed in this stagnant water.
Yes.
Yes, Robert.
What I got from your talk was the significance and importance of meditation.
Mm-hmm.
The examples you gave was what you call the wrong side of the track. What I would call it is the different side of the track. Because some of the, I've heard examples of meditation in the reverse of what you, of the examples that you gave. So sometimes meditation can bring a soul from the other side of the track to a different side, or a different side to the other side. And we wonder sometimes, which is it? And I call it it because of a lack of a description.
Mm-hmm.
So,
very well observed, Robert. Absolutely. Meditation is not, and Dr. Mudge was saying the same thing, it's not a panacea, it's not a one-size-fits-all. But what we learn from each of these examples is that in one way or another, turning within, we find much more than we had any idea of when we were living or abiding in a way that where we were cooperating with our limitations. So we must not cooperate with our limitations. We must push for more and more openness. Each of these people, the only one who learned to meditate in the way that we would think about it, is Dr. Doty. He learned a form of meditation and visualization. Temple Grandin learned to be quiet. She actually, if you see, she actually designed a contraption for herself to help her physically be quiet. And when she did, marvelous things happened to her. Jill Bolte Taylor had no choice. The chatterbox was just made silent by this massive stroke. And I tell you, it is really something in reading that book to see the description written by a neuroscientist of a neuroscientist having a massive stroke. She describes it in a way that we would never think to describe. But then she finds herself in this, what she said it was a decision that she had to make to emerge from that right brain personality, that right hemisphere personality. It was so peaceful and blissful and integrated. I didn't go into all of that. But it was, she had to decide, I will make my way back out of here to where I am, both hemispheres of my brain. But she would always say afterwards, when I get troubled, or when people are assailing me, I just sit to the right. That is, she just retreats into that right hemisphere personality, where there's peace. And Jesus says, I have a choice about what's going on out here. I don't have to be captivated by it. And this is why the integration with Karma Yoga. Karma Yoga teaches us how not to be captivated by our activities and our love of the results of our activities and our vanity and all of the things that are hooked up with selfishness, with materialism and vanity. But today's talk was not so much about karma yoga practices, but about the fact that we do rehearse a vision of reality, but that is very malleable if we make the effort. And so we need not be imprisoned so that we can do the things that are promised by karma yoga. I mean, Krishna's promises are pretty extravagant, you know. Save you from the terrible wheel of rebirth and death. Yes, Dr. Muli. Oh,
thank you very much. This is a, you know, very enlightening lecture. You know, it's, we are all so fortunate, without going through all those difficulties what those three people had.
Yes.
We are getting the same knowledge by practicing karma and, meditation. We could change our attitude. Even the Jyotirmayi, it is all the attitudinal change from left brain to right brain.
Mm-hmm.
In the same way, we could do the same thing by practicing without going through all those difficulties.
Yes.
And the second thing is, Vivekananda says, yeah, compassion is very good. That's what we need. But he says, compassion connotes the feeling of pity.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not the pity you need. You need the love.
Mm-hmm. Yes, you're absolutely right. And, of course, that is moving toward an ever higher reality. Compassion is better than indifference. Love is better than compassion. We climb the stairs one by one. I would much prefer a person who acts out of compassion even if they were a little condescending, than to someone who just turns a blind eye or a cold shoulder to the world and to me. Yes, Sundar.
You hold these tales, talk, sorry, about when you were mentioning about her. So you told that nothing external can disturb my mind and heart. So that's what she told. So does it mean that she was living in a different plane of consciousness level?
No, she simply recognized the choice. Yes, she was living in a different... She had accessed this place of peace and integration, unity, this right mind, this right hemisphere personality. If you read the description, you'll perfectly recognize it as a sage's point of view. A sage, of course, has that point of view and has the capacity to use all the tools of the left hemisphere. But what she said is, I simply do not have to be a prisoner of what happens outside of me. Something terrible happened to her. Most people would have been defeated by it utterly. They never would have emerged from it. It took her 8 years, only 8 years if you think of it that way. But it took her 8 years of unremitting effort to recover her left hemisphere function. But when she did, she discovered that she did not need to be possessed by what happens here. She could be perfectly composed in the face of the most horrible challenge because it was her choice. And this is what we learn through the practice of concentration and meditation, is that we are choosing, we are affirming, we continue to affirm a vision of reality that we have learned. We continue to reaffirm it. And it is not necessarily so. So we have the choice. And this is what Jill Bolte Taylor so strongly asserts, that it became her choice whether to cooperate or not to cooperate with what was happening outside of her. And if she did cooperate, she could cooperate from a very different place than she had automatically cooperated or operated before. I encourage you to read the book. It's only about half an inch thick. It's not a great long read. She really was quite economical in her telling of this story. And it's a great story. She rediscovers many of the things, or she discovers for her own, I shouldn't say rediscovers, she discovers for herself many of the things that Patanjali talks about in the Yoga Sutras, about our states of mind, and how to move from where we are to some place more, just call it satisfactory, less imprisoned. Anybody else? Yes, dear.
How does one rewrite the play without feeling a sense of defeat? Or, like, sometimes when the world comes at you and you want to rewrite the play, but also as you're rewriting the play, sometimes there's a sense of despair or a feeling of loss when you're rewriting it, rather than the bliss? Or is there a stage where you transition from feeling defeated versus feeling blissful when you are trying to, you know, rewrite the play?
the rewriting of the play does not have to have any component of self-defeat or defeat in it. I mean, yes, the world defeats us. We don't always succeed. We don't always win. And that's why the Beatles wrote those lines. It really doesn't matter if I'm wrong. I'm right where I belong. I'm right where I belong. It's our impatience with change. It's our impatience that gets us into trouble, because it just further agitates the mind. So instead of doing what's necessary to calm the mind, in which state we see much more clearly and make better decisions about how to rewrite the play, we feel compelled. I have to hurry up. I have to get this done. I have to overcome this defeat, whatever it is. We do not have to. It's our choice. And that's what, this is what was underlined by each of these three examples. These people took a choice. In the beginning, Temple Grandin's mother was the one making the choice for her. She pushed her to do this. And this little girl was quite autistic, and so it was very difficult for her. But she learned to talk, she learned to read, and her mother said, okay, now you can talk, you can read, you're going to school. Oh, no. Yes. Jill Bolte Taylor also had a mother who helped her tremendously during the early years of her recovery from this. She didn't even, at the point that her mother came to her to be of service to her, Jill Bolte Taylor didn't even know what mother meant. She didn't know what mother was. The divine mother in the form of this woman at the magic shop who was of service to James Doty, the man who came to the doctor and the Stanford person. His birth mother was very severely compromised, invalid and alcoholic. His father wasn't much better. Anybody else? Yes, Paul.
You're mentioning this possibility of being unaffected by external events or external history, it seems like the phenomenon of the spiritual bypass, where people prematurely go to a state of kind of a superficial forgiveness.
Oh yes.
Or a state of denial, an acceptance based on denial, or even something extreme like a prefrontal lobotomy, or psychosurgery. I mean, I find something commendable in like the Book of Psalms in the Old Testament, where they weep and they curse.
Oh yes.
You know, but it's more. They're being, they're very real, and they're weeping and they're cursing, you know. And I don't know. I guess that navigating, when do I, if I deal with my, my honest reaction or my actual, this local identity, this separate self has a reaction, and when do I stop that, or when do I express
it? It isn't a question of you stopping it. It's what I mean. It's not suppression. It's not repression. It's something you learn something new that makes this no longer useful to you. We express anger and weeping and so on as long as we need to. The yogi doesn't become immune to those things the yogi simply rises above them, not as a pretense, but as an actual fact. If we read in Bhagavad Gita the description of Shtita Prajna, the balanced individual, they are indifferent. Why? As Vivekananda points out in his poem, Song of the Sannyasin, just take the instance of someone who's praising you or someone who's blaming you fiercely. Vivekananda says, you become unavailable to that when you truly know that praiser praised and blamer blamed are one. When you really know that, and this is what Jill Bolte Taylor learned, as I said, this right hemisphere state she was in was one of integration and unity. She felt, and this is why it was so hard for her to really make the effort in the beginning to emerge from that. But when you are truly in that state, when you truly know that praiser praised and blamer blamed are one, you are not puffed up by praise, you are not cast down by blame. Now, this is an ideal to be reached by knowledge, not by pretense, not by posturing. You can take a stand for things. I take a stand for the higher rather than the lower. But never hypocrisy. No bullshit. I mean, just none. If we're doing that, we've missed the mark by a mile. False piety, pretense, hypocrisy, useless, worse than useless. It actually drags us down. So no pretense, honesty.
So I wonder if Jesus had been higher involved, you know, when he cleared the temple of the moneylenders.
Mm-hmm.
He went through with a whip and a scourge and drove out some of the moneylenders. If he had been higher involved, would he have been indifferent to that, or that they were making what was supposed to be a house of prayer into a place of hypocrisy or of financial gain?
No, I think he was genuinely angry that his father's house was being defiled by these people who were making it a place of commerce. I think he was. I don't think there was any posturing in this at all, and I don't think it's a question of how highly evolved he was. I think he just genuinely was totally incensed by, you know, this is the Temple of Solomon. This is not just some little, you know, wayside inn.
I guess I just have trouble reconciling the higher view of absolute peace and surrender, or that you're suggesting, where you're totally free of external aggravations, you know, with someone who is reacting to an injustice, responding to an injustice, to
righteous indignation, righteous anger. We must not be passive in the face of insult. We must not be doormats. We must not. It's cowardly. And it drags us down. Now, could Jesus have mastered his anger? I suppose so. Was he right in doing what he did? It's far, far, far above my paycheck to make that judgment. But I admire what he did, just personally. I admire what he did. Because he knew it would get him killed. The things he did, he knew would get him killed. And he did them anyway. Just like Martin Luther King, just like Gandhi, just like so many others. Just they knew that what they were doing. I mean, John Lennon in his Ballad of John and Yoko, he said, Christ, and he's speaking directly to Christ, Christ, you know it ain't easy. You know it's hard as can be. The way things are going, they're going to crucify me. And that's what happened. He was shot to death. And that was no accident. That was an assassination, in my opinion. But he sang that in that song. And to work for peace, to do what is necessary, to be righteously indignant in the face of the provocations of the mighty. Christ, you know it ain't easy. It's hard as can be. The way things are going, they're going to crucify me. Right now, such horrors are being practiced in the name of this nation. And just how much longer we can sit here and not go to the southern border, I don't know. What can be done otherwise is being done. But I mean, this is impermissible. So, Sri Ramakrishna said over and over, what happens in the mind, what happens by the lips, and what happens by the hand must all be in perfect accord. No disconnect between what's being thought, what's being said, and what's being done. They have to be in perfect harmony. And if you are angry, what he said to his beloved assistant, Fridoy, he said, when I am angry, you be quiet. When you are angry, I'll be quiet. Saints get angry. Joan of Arc. Woo! You read the stories of Joan of Arc. She would really blow her stack. Then she'd return to her serenity and perfect ability to decide what to do next. This is good. Anything else? Well, I know for a fact we have got a table loaded with delights inside. Because I know what was there before Jyotiji started working on it. So if we're ready to continue our fellowship inside, I'll just close with our prayer for peace. Again, this lovely translation by Swami Yogeshananda. Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in outer space.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the sky, on the earth, and in the waters.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
Let there be peace in the herbs, the plants, and the trees.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the gods be peaceful.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
May the whole universe be pervaded by peace.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Let this infinite universal peace prevail throughout my being.
Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Peace, peace, peace be unto us and to all beings everywhere. And if that actually happened, then there would be nothing left but Hawking radiation, the night of Brahma, and this would all disappear. So it's not going to be peaceful that quick. So I'll see you inside.